Now, I don't know this week whether you've read or you've been following news stories, particularly the story about Matthew Bryce. Maybe you've heard about this 22-year-old Scottish surfer who was surfing off the coastline of Scotland and was taken out 16 miles away from the coast and was stranded for 32 hours. Overnight, one night in the open ocean, just clinging onto a surfboard. And as sunset approached for the second night, he had given up all hope. And he says, "I had made peace with myself and was ready to die." And then at 7:30 that evening, a helicopter found him clinging to a surfboard. It's quite amazing to see the scene. I don't know if you saw that. His life, we might say, was saved or redeemed. We might say that. We could say his life was redeemed from death. He thought he was dead. His life was given back to him. Now, the book of Ruth has been following the fortunes, for want of a better word, of an Israelite family in the hardest of times. In chapter 1, we saw that moving away from the promised land to a foreign country only led to disaster, and that it was returning and clinging to the Lord that was the only hope for this family. Naomi and Ruth came back. In chapter 2, last week, we saw that those who do take shelter under the wings of God find favor, and we saw the wonderful truth that even foreigners, people outside, can take refuge, find favor, and become family. Isn't that an amazing, amazing truth? And now in chapter 3, the main theme is kind of redemption, really. The idea of redemption was brought to our attention in chapter 2. Boaz, we're told right at the beginning of chapter 2, was from the clan of Elimelech. Naomi knows and tells Ruth later on here is a potential redeemer. Now, a redeemer, which we'll come on to think about a bit later on, in the kind of the broadest kind of sense, was someone who might feel responsible to help and to save a family that they belong to in their desperate situation. So here is Boaz, and Naomi identifies him as a redeemer, a close relative, someone who God may have sent to their aid. And Naomi and Ruth, you see, were a little bit like this man at sea. See, they were childless widows, clinging onto their surfboard, if you like. The Lord is their surfboard, of course, and they were at his mercy. They needed redemption. So we see this morning that they sought redemption, they were promised redemption, and they were pledged redemption. And chapter 3, in kind of the way it's kind of structured, very similar to chapter 2, there are three main scenes. The first and the last scenes are at home. The middle scene is at the threshing floor. So we have at home with Naomi and Ruth, at the threshing floor with Ruth and Boaz, and at home again with Naomi and Ruth. So let's think about these three things together. Firstly, that redemption we see in scene 1 is sought. It's sought out, it's searched for by this family, particularly Naomi. Look at chapter 3, verse 1. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, "My daughter, I must find a home for you where you'll be well provided for. Now, Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight he'll be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfume, get dressed in your best clothes, go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you're there till he's finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying, then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do." And Ruth responds, "I will do whatever you say." And there's a couple of things I want to highlight under this heading. And that's the first thing is that they've seen their need for a more permanent rest. They've seen their need for a more permanent rest. Now, you may have a footnote. I've got one in my NIV here that I've got, which says that the phrase "I must find a home" is more literally "I must find rest." So if you've got an English Standard Version, you might have something like, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may go well with you?" And the reason it's worth just pointing that out is that this is the same idea, this is the same prayer that Ruth had for Orpah and Ruth back in chapter 1, verse 9. She prays, or at least kind of wishes, "May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." So clearly, by rest, she means a husband and a home, which is why the NIV says home, which is all very clear. But it's very worth noting that. You see, the reason it's worth noting that is just because, as wonderful as the Lord's provision for Naomi and Ruth was in chapter 2, it was only temporary. See, in fact, chapter 2 ends with this kind of note of tension. This is a storyteller. We're in a story. I know we just read chapter 3 today, but if we were read it all the way through, we'd notice that there were kind of points of tension and release. And the end of chapter 2 ends really on a point of tension. You see, chapter 1 set up this kind of idea that here are these two people coming back. And at the end of chapter 1, we're told the barley harvest was beginning. We ended chapter 1 with this kind of note of hope. Chapter 2, then, is in the barley harvest, and it's the Lord's amazing provision. But it was only a temporary provision. So you see what happened at the end of chapter 2, the last verse. So Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvests were finished. And she lived with her mother-in-law. You see, whilst the harvest was going on, there was great hope and great provision. But it's over. The barley harvest is finished. And where's Ruth? Oh, she's still living with her mother-in-law. No, that's a bad thing. But actually, it's a temporary provision. It's not bad to live with your mother-in-law. I'm just saying it's, yeah. It was a temporary thing. It wasn't where she was going to. Naomi was going to die at some point, and Ruth was going to be on her own. There's a sense of tension. And it's really, really interesting that verse 23, Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz. We could translate that. Ruth clung to the women of Boaz, just like Ruth had at chapter 1, clung to Naomi, and therefore clung to the Lord. Now she was beginning to cling to that which was Boaz's. But as she begins to cling to this new home, the barley and the wheat harvest were finished, and she's going back home to live with her mother-in-law. You can sense the kind of the tension, the kind of, you know, if you're watching a film, you'd be there going, no, something's got to happen. So Naomi, we see, wishes to find rest, a more permanent solution to Ruth's plight. And the question we're faced with at the beginning of chapter 3 is, will she succeed? Will this turn out all right? Will they find rest? Now, the second thing we can see in verses 2 to 5 is the kind of the expert planning of Naomi, right, to put Ruth and herself, and I've got this phrase which I've coined, which we can debate later, but they put themselves in the way of God's mercy. That's what I think is happening. They put themselves in the place where they can benefit from the Lord's mercy. You see, having previously prayed, or at least wished, that the Lord would give Ruth rest, Naomi now sees herself as kind of the answer to her own prayers. Naomi hatches a plan. You know, Ruth needs a husband. Naomi's going to use all she knows about Boaz, all she knows about the customs and the traditions of the people that she lives amongst, and everything she knows about the law of God to bring about, as far as she is able to, rest for Ruth. See, verse 2, she sees Boaz clearly as an answer to their plight. She's already identified him as a redeemer in chapter 2, a family member who may feel a duty to help them. Well, here she reminds Ruth that he is a relative. And she also reminds her that he's a relative who's already shown a degree of favour towards them. Do you see that in verse 2? Now, Boaz, with whose women you have worked, there's the favour, is a relative of ours. There's the Redeemer. So a favourable Redeemer has already shown himself and proved himself willing to help. And so she sees that and perceives that in Boaz. She also knows the customs of the day. So she's like, well, tonight he'll be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Now, we're not farmers here. Let me just explain. You might know, but let me just explain what that is, just to be clear. Harvesting is finished after the harvesting, which is, you know, cutting all the wheat down and bundling it up and putting it in a safe place. They thresh it, right? Which means they just bash it with hard stone. And the idea is to get the kernel out of the rest of the stuff, right? Like the chaff and the stalks and all that kind of stuff. And then winnowing is where they kind of get a fork and they shove it up in the air and the wind blows away all the chaff, all the light stuff, and all the heavy kind of grain falls to the floor, you know? Amazing. So that's why they had to go probably down to the threshing floor. The threshing floor is probably downwind and it's in a particular place and it's a particular time. Maybe it was a windy night and she knew Boaz would be winnowing tonight. And so there he is. And it's hard work. Takes ages, apparently, to thresh and to winnow. And she knows all of that. So, she knows Boaz will be winnowing. She knows the customs of the day. And she hatches a plan. Don't forget, this is probably the first harvest in at least 10 years. Can you imagine the joyous celebration, the feasting? Yes, God has visited his people. I'm winnowing. Wow, amazing. And I'm also having a nice meal and a glass of wine on the side. Amazing. And she knows that Boaz is going to be involved in that. So she hatches a plan. Says, Ruth, do yourself up, make yourself look nice and smell nice. Go down to the threshing floor where Boaz will be and wait until he's in a good mood after feasting. See where he lies down, uncover his feet, lie down next to them, and just see what happens. What's going to happen next? Now, it's not like, there are some people like this, I'm sure, I hope there aren't any here. There are some people who are just like obsessed with marriage and relationships, right, and getting their kind of children paired off. That is not what's going on. We've got to understand that for Naomi, having a husband was a matter of survival. This is a matter of protection, of security, and of survival. I don't know if you've seen the play or the film, read the book Fiddler on the Roof. If you have, there's this person, this character in it called Jente, who's the village matchmaker. And she goes around, and her job basically is to go around pairing up all these women with all these blokes. And it's a Jewish community, and in a sense, it gives us this kind of sense of the idea, the importance of having protection and provision and security. If you're a childless widow, you had none of that. And so this is what Naomi was doing. She was providing rest and protection and security for Ruth for the future. She is doing what I have called putting Ruth in the way of God's mercy. Now, I think this is a helpful image because just imagine just the way you may kind of put yourself in the way of the rays of the sun when you're on holiday. You know, the sun is shining, it's really hot, you're in the shade, and you just kind of like move out into the sun to benefit from what's already there. Or maybe you turn the shower on in the morning and, you know, it's cold or whatever to start with, but then you put yourself in the way of the flow of water. I just think that's a helpful image to see what's going on here. See, that's what she's doing. She knows what God is like. She knows what God's law says. She knows what the customs are like. She knows the character of Boaz. And she puts Ruth in the flow, in the rays of the sun. Now, I'm pretty sure that she is still trusting in the sovereignty of God. Verse 4 is very helpful, isn't it? When he lies down, note the place where he's lying, go and uncover his feet and lie down. He'll tell you what to do. As in, I'm not quite sure what's going to happen next. I have an idea of what I'd like to happen, but actually, from there on, I can't guarantee anything. I kind of think, in the back of her mind, is this kind of her knowledge of God, her knowledge of the customs, her knowledge of Boaz, her trust in the Lord's sovereignty. Now, I think this is all helpful for us in a couple of ways. Firstly, thinking about rest. You know, the Bible tells us that final rest is what we all need. Final rest is what we're all kind of striving for. If you've been keeping up with royal news this week, you'll have heard about Prince Philip retiring after 70 years. He's 95 and he's standing down from his duties. Even Jeremy Corbyn managed to wish him well in his well-earned retirement. That's saying something. And it does seem that all the hard work we put in life, to what end? Well, we're all looking forward to retirement, aren't we? Or something like that. I used to work with a lady whose husband could tell you any day, you could phone him up any day, and he would tell you, without thinking about it too hard, how many days he had left till retirement. You see, retirement was where he was heading. He was living for retirement. I imagine he's retired now. I have no idea. I hope he's a happy chap. But the point is that we all desire rest. We desire actually permanent and true rest. And God says that the only way we get that is by putting ourselves in the way of God's mercy. You see, the Bible tells us we all need redemption, not from physical poverty, but from sin, from spiritual poverty. We're like that man, aren't we, in the Irish Sea. We need to be clinging on to the surfboard, needing, longing for the helicopter to come. And that surfboard, you know, is provided for us. That's God's mercy. You know, the current of sin is too strong. It's taking us out. Sunset's approaching. What is your hope? What are you going to hold on to? Well, God says your only hope is to put yourselves in the way of God's mercy. Cling to the surfboard that is the gospel, if you like. Jesus' death alone takes away our sin and redeems us. But once you've done that, you can still put yourself in the way of God's mercy. That's what we're doing this morning, isn't it? We're putting ourselves in the way of it. We're deliberately choosing to be amongst his people. We're deliberately choosing to hear his word taught. We're deliberately choosing to sing songs and to put ourselves in the way of the mercy of God. Each day, we need to be trusting Jesus, our Redeemer, the one who one day will bring us home to final rest. The helicopter is on its way. Just hold tight to the gospel. Now, I think this is important because people naturally cling elsewhere, don't they? You know that I like song lyrics. Let me give you a few song lyrics from a current song, which shows you where other people are hanging on. Ain't got a soapbox I can stand upon, but God, interesting, gave me a stage, a guitar and a song. My daddy told me, son, don't you get involved in politics, religions, or other people's quotes. So religion isn't the way forward. I'll paint a picture. Let me set the scene. I know when I have children, they will know what it means. And I'll pass on these things my family's given to me. Just love, understanding, and positivity. That's all we need. We could change this whole world with a piano. Add a bass, some guitar, grab a beat, and away we go. I'm just a boy with a one-man show. No university, no degree, but Lord knows. Everyone's talking about exponential growth and the stock market crashing in their portfolios. Well, I'm sitting here with a song that I wrote, saying love could change the world in a moment. But what do I know? Love's the answer, isn't it? That's what people are holding on to. And in a sense, love is the answer. And the problem is that nobody's got it. You know, we need love. We need the love of God to change the world. But actually, we don't love. You know, we need more than just love, understanding, and positivity. We need a flipping heart transplant, don't we? We need to be completely different people. We need to love like we cannot possibly love without God. We need to cling on to what God has given us. Also, I think Naomi is helpful in teaching us how to act responsibly within the larger context of God's sovereignty. You know, her wish for Ruth to find rest in chapter 1 doesn't mean she doesn't strive to provide her with rest in chapter 3. I think that's really helpful, isn't it? We saw last week, didn't we, that taking shelter under God's wings for Ruth meant working really hard, actually. That's how she did it. Trusting in God's sovereignty doesn't mean inactivity. It means active trust. So we pray, but we organize and we plan and we strategize and we use the knowledge that we have. We try and make the best decisions. We organize Christianity Explored. You know, we write to trust funds to try and get some money. And, you know, sometimes we get some, sometimes we don't. But the point is, we trust in God's sovereignty, don't we? We work hard and we strategize and we do all we can. But actually, at the end of the day, we rely on the Lord. The outcomes are all His. The praise is all His. The glory is all His. That's redemption sought. Let's have a look at redemption promised. Scene 1, at home with Ruth and Naomi, sought redemption. Scene 2, at the threshing floor with Ruth and Boaz. And we see the promise of redemption. In center stage, we see a godly woman and a faithful redeemer, or a faithful potential redeemer at this point. Let's read through the story together, first of all, before we learn, we think what we can learn about it. And the first thing we were told is that Ruth, as promised, does everything that Naomi told her to do. And then verse 7 continues, when Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. Now, I don't think we're meant to think that Boaz was kind of, you know, out of it and plastered. I just think, you know, he's just had a nice meal, and he's, you know, he's had a glass of wine, and he feels really satisfied, like you might do after a good meal. And here he is. It's hard work winnowing. It's really hard work. He's had a nice meal after hard work, and he lies down to sleep. He acts just like Naomi has predicted. So far, so good. What happens next, though, is out of Naomi's control. How would her plan fare? Verse 8. In the middle of the night, something startled the man. Some people suggest that, you know, he had cold feet and he woke up because he had cold feet. that might be true. Anyway, he turned. Clearly, it wasn't her that startled her. He was startled by something. Maybe he had a bad dream, I don't know. But he turned, and there was a woman lying at his feet. Now, it's not 100% clear why she uncovered his feet, but actually, it does seem to be something symbolic, doesn't it? So she's uncovered his feet, and she's lying at his feet, we learn a bit later, symbolically, perhaps, showing her submission and her openness to marriage. Some people suggest that she's showing her mourning period is over. You know, she's been mourning her the death of her husband, and she's not allowed to smell nice and dress nice and that kind of stuff. Well, that may be the case too, which clearly she's showing that she's open. I'm open to a marriage proposal, Boaz. Well, he turns around in verse 9. Who are you? And this is where Ruth has to improvise. There's no script from Naomi here. I am your servant, Ruth, she said. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family. Now, what's less clear in the NIV than the ESV here, I think, is this kind of wordplay, you might say, that's going on here. So the phrase, corner of your garment, is the same word as used earlier for wings. All right, so actually when she says that, she's kind of saying, spread your wings, your cover your garment, over me. And this should sound familiar to us. Isn't that what Boaz commended Ruth for in chapter 2, for taking refuge under the wings, same word, of the God of Israel? She's asking Boaz to do the same for her. In seeking Boaz for a husband, she's seeking refuge under the wings of God. And this imagery also is there in Ezekiel 16. I don't know if you know Ezekiel 16, it's a really graphic chapter, okay? Let me read you a bit of it to give you a bit of the flavour. It's a depiction of Israel as an abandoned newborn baby in a field. God says, then I passed by, speaking to Israel, and saw you kicking about in your blood, And as you lay there in your blood, I said to you, live. Later I passed by, and when I looked at you and saw that you were old enough for love, I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your naked body. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the Sovereign Lord, and you became mine. How did the Lord propose? How did the Lord propose to Israel? How did he take her under his wing? Well, he made her his wife. God married Israel, in a sense. That's the image. And so what's going on here is Ruth is saying, I'm open to marriage. I'm open to you covering me with your cloak, symbolically, literally, but I'm open to marriage. I think that's what's going on here. What's unusual, perhaps, is the basis of her appeal. So she says, spread the corner of your garment over me. You know, come on, marry me, Boaz. Since you are a guardian redeemer of our family. Now, we thought last week that this idea of the role of a redeemer being laid out in the Old Testament. So Leviticus 25, you can check out some of those things. But the main duty of the redeemer was to buy back land or to buy back people who've had to sell themselves into slavery because of their poverty. So a redeemer would come back and he'd say, I'm going to buy that land off of you and give it back to my family member. Or I'm going to buy that woman from you out of slavery and give her a freedom. That was the role of a redeemer. And what is surprising perhaps here is that nowhere in the Old Testament does it suggest that marrying a relative's widow is part of the role of a redeemer. And so there's a question. Has Ruth got it kind of slightly wrong? Did she not really understand Jewish law? And I think that's probably not true. But what I do think is probably true is as we've been reading through the Old Testament law, we've seen, haven't we, that the Old Testament often lays down principles. And they're not restrictive. The application of those principles are almost as wide as the need. And so I think what's going on here is that although marriage isn't something which is specifically laid out as a duty of the Redeemer, it certainly could include that. You know, if you've got a family member who's in need, then marriage could be a part of that. And Boaz responds, you see. He doesn't say, oh, hold on, Ruth, come on, you can't lay that one on me. you've got the law. No, he says, the Lord bless you, my daughter. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich and poor or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do all you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character. Now, when Boaz says, oh, this kindness is greater than that, I don't think he's saying, oh, what, you've chosen me? Well, you could have chosen anyone you wanted. But I'm flattered. I don't think he's actually meaning that necessarily. I think what he's saying, this kindness, what kindness? The kindness that you're willing to marry a guy, he's probably a lot older than you, and he's, you know, you're not marrying for love or for money. You're marrying because of your fulfilling your duty to your mother-in-law. That's kind, isn't it? The kindness that she had shown before was leaving her home, hometown, her family, joining with Naomi, working hard for her in the field. And this greater kindness is that now you're even willing to marry someone in order to show your loyalty to this family. And then, verse 12, there comes a twist in the tale. This drama is twisting. There's a closer relative who has priority. But verse 13, he assures her that one way or another, a redeemer will be provided. Either this bloke, or I'll do it if he won't. Redemption is promised, it's guaranteed. She can sleep easy that night. So verse 14, she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized and said, and he said, no one must know that a woman came to the threshing floor. Now, we've read through the story a bit more. I just want to make a couple of points from this. I think we see a faithful Redeemer and a godly woman. Let's have a think about the faithful Redeemer. You see, I think he's faithful because he doesn't take advantage of Ruth when it would have been easy for him to have done so. Now, I have to say that virtually every commentator agrees that this is a scene which is highly sexually charged. Okay? The language is very suggestive, it has sexual overtones. Hebrew readers would not be in the dark about the potential for what might have happened at this scene. It's a bit like watching a film. You know, you watch a film and the film writer or the director wants you to be on the edge of your seats thinking, you know, what's going to happen next? What is potentially going to happen here? And that's what's going on. You see? So not only is the language quite suggestive, did you notice how the characters are kind of nameless most of the time now? It's not Ruth and Boaz, it's the man and the woman. They're in the dark. This is kind of like this sense of kind of like they're on their own. They're in this kind of secret place. No one can recognize them. It is actually really dark, probably, at this place. The other thing a Hebrew reader would have been aware of is that here is a Moabite woman in the presence of an Israelite man. And if your history of the Israelite nation is any good, you'll remember Numbers 25. Certainly all Israelites would remember this. That time where it was the Moabite women who seduced and led astray the whole Israelite camp. See, here was history kind of repeating itself in microcosm. Here was the Moabite woman in the presence of the Israelite man. Surely the outcome is inevitable. But that's exactly the point. Nothing happens. Boaz is faithful. Isn't that amazing? Boaz is the faithful Israelite. See, all this kind of, you know, imagery, all this kind of ramping up of the kind of heightening of the situation is there to highlight, actually, the faithfulness of the Redeemer. Naomi had got Boaz right. He was a man of noble character, a godly man. The Israelite did the right thing on this occasion by the Moabite woman, just at the point where Israel had previously failed. See, here is a faithful Redeemer. But also there's a godly woman, isn't there? There's a godly woman. See, she was obedient, verse 5 and 6, and submissive. She promised to carry out everything Naomi had commanded. Verse 6 shows us that she did everything that Naomi commanded. Also, we can see that she was loyal. She was loyal to Naomi and loyal to the family. As I've already said in verse 10, when Boaz says, "The Lord bless you," you know, she hasn't sought for to marry for love or money, we might say. You know, she hasn't kind of chosen the best-looking guy, and she hasn't chosen the richest guy. You know, she's chosen Boaz out of loyalty to Naomi. See, this is a godly woman. And did you notice what Boaz says in verse 11? "Now, my daughter, do not be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character." Now, it's worth just thinking about that phrase a minute. A woman of noble character. Now, in our Bibles, the order of the books in the Bible is not, I don't think, inspired particularly. Even though the contents clearly are. And in the Hebrew Bible, in fact, in my Hebrew Bible, I can show you later, Ruth doesn't come after Judges. You know, that's a chronological thing. You know, we've put it there following the Septuagint, which has put it in chronological order. It happened at the time of Judges, so let's put Ruth next to Judges. But in the Hebrew Bible, in my Hebrew Bible, it comes after Proverbs. It's in part of the writings. And if you just read Proverbs, and you just read Proverbs 31, this picture of the model Israelite woman. A woman of noble character, actually. Same phrase. What are you going to be thinking when you read Ruth? You're going to be thinking, oh, here is a woman of noble character. But what's striking about Ruth is that she's not an Israelite. And yet here is a foreigner who's been brought outside, from the outside to the inside, and now lives the life of the model Israelite. In fact, it's even more striking than that. Having read Proverbs, Proverbs 31 is the kind of the great positive image of Proverbs chapter 5, which is the terrible image of the wayward woman. Proverbs 5, you have the wayward woman. Proverbs 31, you have the godly woman. And in Ruth, in chapter 2, she describes herself exactly using the same word as the wayward woman when she calls herself a foreigner. That's the same word in Proverbs 5. So Ruth, the foreigner, has become a woman of noble character. The wayward woman has become a woman, the model Israelite, by placing herself in the way of the mercy of God, by clinging to him, by clinging to his people, by placing herself under the wings of God. See, Jesus is our faithful Redeemer, isn't he? He's a bit like Boaz. He shows us what it's... Boaz shows us in a way what Jesus is going to be like. He's faithful. He doesn't do anything wrong. He was like us in every way, apart from our sin. Perfectly faithful. Perfectly sinless, so that he might take upon himself our sin, and so that we might become his righteousness. If Christ had no righteousness, we couldn't have received it. But he also gives us an example of what it looks like to live faithfully whilst we wait for redemption. Isn't that right? As Jesus was faithful, so too should we be. And I think it also shows us what the gospel does. The gospel takes us from the outside and turns us into insiders. It takes us from foreigners, from wayward people, into people who can be called holy and righteous. Not because of anything we have done, but because we have put our way, ourselves, in the way of the Lord's mercy. We have been clothed with the righteousness of Christ. Our filthy rags have been ripped off us, and we've been clothed in royalty. We look like princes and princesses because of the righteousness of Christ. Wow, redemption promised. Finally, and much more and far too briefly, let's go to scene 3. Back home, we see. Back home with Ruth and Naomi. Redemption's been sought, redemption has been promised, and now redemption is pledged. Scene 2 ended with Boaz pouring out 6 measures of barley into Ruth's shawl. And the significance of this act isn't brought home, well, until it's brought home in verses 16 and 17. When Ruth came to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, how did it go, my daughter? And she told her everything Boaz had done and added, and he gave me these 6 measures of barley, saying, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Naomi said, wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens, for the man will not rest until the matter is settled today. Now, Naomi's first question to Ruth when she comes back is quite interesting. In Hebrew, it's the same one that Boaz asked in verse 9. Who are you? Can you imagine that? Who are you? Well, clearly she doesn't not know who she is. Right, because she's expecting, she knows who it is. It's light now, perhaps. She knows who it is. So what's she saying? What's the answer she wants? It's not, oh, I'm Ruth. One commentator puts it like this. Are you his wife or not? You're knocking on the door. Who are you? Are you his wife or not? That may be the kind of nuance there. But certainly Naomi wants to know, has the plan worked? Do they have a redeemer? And Ruth told her all that the man had done. And then comes the significance of these 6 measures of barley. These 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty to your mother-in-law. That's what it says, kind of, I guess, more literally. You must not go back empty. Now, is that ringing any bells? You must not go back empty. What is it that Naomi said of herself as she came into the town of Bethlehem at the end of chapter 1? And they said, oh, it's Naomi. She said, no, don't call me Naomi. Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. And here is Boaz sending Ruth back to her mother-in-law, full, who had come empty. You see, the Lord who had brought Naomi back empty was filling her up again. The barley was the pledge of redemption. Now, if you've been following the reports of the local elections this week, you'll know that one big question everyone has is, do these results hold promise for what is to come? You know, is this a little picture? Or can we expect a conservative landslide in the general election? Is this kind of a sign of what is to come? And that's the big question. Some people think it is, others are more cautious. But that's not what's going on here. Here is a definite pledge of something that is definitely going to come. See, these 6 measures of barley were a pledge that redemption was near. Hold on tight, says Boaz, to these 6 measures of barley. This is my pledge. Redemption is coming. And Naomi sees that. She says, he will not rest until it is sorted out today. Now, it strikes me that we're in a kind of similar situation, aren't we? We too live in the present, looking forward, don't we, to the full redemption that we have been promised. Jesus is our Redeemer. And of course, there's a sense in which we've already been redeemed. 1 Peter, for you know that it was not with perishable things, such as silver or gold, you were redeemed, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. But yet there's a future aspect, isn't there, to redemption as well. There's more to come. Ephesians captures this well. Chapter 1, verse 7 says, in him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins. Chapter 4, verse 10 tells us not to grieve the Spirit of God, with whom you are sealed for the day of redemption. See, the redemption has been pledged to us by the Holy Spirit. How do you know you have forgiveness of sins? How do you know that on the last day the helicopter is going to pick you up out of the freezing water? Because you're clinging hold of the surfboard. You're clinging on to the fact that in Jesus we have redemption promised that will one day be finally realized. As Paul writes in Romans 8:23, we who have the first fruits of the Spirit, the pledge, we groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies. You see, in the meantime, whilst we're waiting, we need to recognize our need of redemption, of final rest. We need to put ourselves in the way of God's mercy. We need to trust the promise of redemption through our faithful Redeemer, Jesus, as we live faithfully clinging on to him. We need to hold on to the pledge of redemption, the Holy Spirit working in us and through us as we wait. It's better than a surfboard. It's our only hope of being saved through death. Redemption is what we all need. It's what we're all promised. And it's what we're pledged in the gospel.